Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. The operative phrase of American foreign policy these days seems to be just say no. A case in point, last week's vote on the Kyoto Protocols on global warming. The vote was 180-1, with the U.S. as the lone dissenter. That lonely role is becoming more familiar. News headlines chronicle the laundry list of international agreements rejected by the U.S. Biological warfare, small weapons, the anti-ballistic missile treaty. It may be a post-Clintonian time of careful and selective reconsideration, or the Bush administration's signal of departure from the era of international cooperation. Regardless, President Bush's actions suggest he's come a long way from the foreign policy philosophy then-candidate Bush expressed 10 months ago during the second presidential debate. Moderator Jim Lehrer asked, how would you project U.S. power around the world? Bush answered this way.
It really depends upon how our nation conducts itself in foreign policy. If we're an arrogant nation, they'll resent us. If we're a humble nation but strong, they'll welcome us. And our nation stands alone right now in the world in terms of power, and that's why we've got to be humble.
Connection listeners, are we looking at a new American approach towards going it alone? What's the significance of this series of decisions to distance ourselves from international agreements? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. That's theconnection.org. I'm joined in the studio by Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. And joining me from a studio in New Haven, Connecticut, is Yale professor of international law, Ruth Wedgwood. Thanks to both of you for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you. Professor Walt, let me start with you. It does appear that you can make a case, at least on the face of it, that President Bush is willing to walk away from many international treaties. Does that mean he's, in effect, walking away from the rest of the world?
No, I think that's too strong a statement. The difficulty they have is that in walking away from this many agreements, it's going to make it more difficult for them to remain engaged in the ways they would like to. The Bush administration has a pretty clear worldview that we're number one. That the rest of the world will follow firm U.S. leadership as long as we're clear and consistent, that even if they don't like it, they don't have a whole lot of choices, that many of these agreements would only bind us in ways that they think are unfortunate, and therefore we shouldn't accept them, and the rest of the world will eventually simply have to accept it. The problem they face is it's hard to be unilateralist, sort of purely self-interested, and simultaneously extensively engaged around the world. Because if you're extensively engaged, that requires getting others to go along with you eventually. So you can be unilateralist and distance yourself from the rest of the world, or you can be multilateralist and engaged. But it's hard to be purely self-interested, purely unilateralist, and yet expect to get cooperation from others.
I mean, what would be the long-term consequences of that, of not getting this cooperation from others?
We're going to find it more difficult to get other countries to support us on issues that we do care about. For example, we couldn't get anybody, really, to go along with us on smart sanctions for Iraq. We're going to encourage other countries to start collaborating with each other, and one little sign of that, we shouldn't make too much of it, but it is important. One little sign of that was the recent Sino-Russian friendship agreement. We're going to create, I think, a generation of foreigners who are looking for opportunities to kick the United States in the shins. Again, you know, not altering the balance of power against us in a fundamental way, but looking for various ways to take us down a peg or two. And perhaps most importantly, it's going to make it harder for us to get the rest of the world to help us when there are things we do want help, whether it's North Korea, a new round of trade talks, the Middle East peace process, what to do in the Gulf, lots of little things. We're basically creating a world where fewer and fewer countries are going to want to help us when we want it.
Professor Wedgwood, let me turn to you. The Bush administration says it's applying a hard-headed assessment of treaties on a case-by-case basis, evaluating them according to American interests. Stated that way, that sounds reasonable, is it?
Well, I think what's going on, in fact, is a confrontation with some real systematic problems that are not only ours, but really blight the current processes of negotiating multilateral agreements. What's happened in the last 8 or 9 years, starting with the Ottawa Landmines Convention, going through the Rome Criminal Court, is a new sense among like-minded countries, so-called, oftentimes Europeans, Canadians, Australians, Norwegians, that they don't really have to worry about signing up the effective players, that they can set a very high, in their minds, high jump to bar to jump over, and then force us to come along, rather than the old idea of international law, which is it should be norms plus the consent of the effective state actors. So one of the worries that I have about the way that the last several years have unfolded is not solely or even mostly that the U.S. has walked away from negotiations, but rather we seem to have lost our efficacy in having others take our interests seriously. And I think part of what's going on with the Bush administration, it may be that they want a marked difference in themselves. It may be that they're thinly populated and lacking a lot of folks who aren't yet confirmed and therefore can't constructively come up with alternatives. But I think at the same time they want to signal that they're not going to be forced to go along with something just because 188 other countries are nominally in favor of it, and that you have to have the effective actors in a particular area, like landmines, be able to have their security interests accommodated.
So is the idea here, I mean, a certain skepticism about international agreements, the notion that in some cases these accords would bind only the honest but provide cover for those who cheat, for example? Is that one of the points that you're talking about here?
Well, that's part of it, and we do have unique verification capabilities because of our technical means of surveillance, so that I think we're less inclined to think that a multilateral set of inspectors, often whose secretariats are, how shall we say, infiltrated by not-so-nice countries, we're less inclined to think that's the way to go rather than relying on our own technical means. But what I also wanted to point to is that there's a mood among other countries, NGOs particularly, and the so-called like-minded, the Europeans who are getting a sense of themselves, that they will create regimes that forbid reservations. Those are the kinds of exceptions that you ordinarily could make to a treaty, that will even disregard reservations that have been entered into. And it's also treaties negotiated by countries that are used to a lot more international integration. Europeans, after all, have delegated a great portion of their sovereignty to the European Union and may find it more, I guess, congenial and normal to give over governmental functions that we would be skeptical about.
Professor Walt, we saw last week in Bonn an extraordinary performance by the Europeans. In a sense, they sort of came together with a new level of cohesion, maybe. Is this sort of a result of the United States' position? Would you view that?
It's a result of two things. First of all, there has been a major structural change that we all know about, right? When the Cold War came to an end, it removed the most important source of glue that always bound the United States and its European allies together, which was the common fear of the Soviet Union. Now, there are other things that bind us and other things we agree on, but the glue has weakened. And you see this in lots of different ways. You see it in a diminished American enthusiasm for its European commitment, the reluctance to go into the Balkans, the continued reluctance to stay there, even though we've said we've done it. And we also see it in greater European assertion. So some of this was already happening under President Clinton. Having said that, I think it's pretty clear that the Bush administration has exacerbated this by not just expressing its own reservations with certain agreements, but doing it in a way that the Europeans and others find as particularly cavalier. To reject the Kyoto Treaty and to do it on the basis that the world's wealthiest country can't afford it, that it would be bad for American consumers while we're busy developing an energy policy that basically calls for more drilling. I mean, this was just inept. Whether or not Kyoto was a good agreement, my own view is it was a flawed agreement, but the way in which we walked away from it sort of took all the onus for killing it on ourselves, and we should have, I think, done that a little bit more smoothly. So it's both the sort of way in which world politics has changed over the last 10 years, for which they are not responsible, and also some of the ways they have responded to that new environment.
There seems to be a paradox in a sense, too, recently. I mean, it seems like we're not cooperating with some of our oldest friends, and yet the one of the places where President Bush seems to be willing to cooperate is with one of our oldest enemies, the Russians. Is that paradoxical, or can you put that into a context that makes sense to me?
I'll try. Those two things actually go together. The administration came into office, and you know, we all should cut them a little bit of slack in the first few months because they are just getting the hang of things, and you're always saddled with a series of extreme positions you may have adopted in the campaign. So there's always a learning process. And one of the things they learned was to simply get up and announce that we were going to build missile defenses and we were going to screw the ABM treaty and we really didn't care what anybody thought about it was not smart diplomatically. And one of the things it got us into trouble with was with our allies. Now, in order to accommodate the Europeans, or at least appease them, we've now adopted a sort of public relations campaign of saying that, look, we're going to do this in partnership with the Russians. And Putin, who, in my view, has been very clever in adopting very moderate positions, saying he's perfectly happy to talk, he's willing to negotiate, he's willing to discuss it. He wants to put the burden of breaking the treaty fully on us. Mm-hmm. Right? If the ABM treaty is going to go down, he wants the fingerprints to be ours all over it. And one of the ways he does that is by sounding as reasonable as possible, because I think he knows that the administration is dead set against the treaty and strongly committed to missile defenses. So in other words, but what you didn't see coming out of Genoa was anything more than a rhetorical commitment on both sides to have some discussions.
Mm-hmm. Comedy, not commitment, in other words.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Both sides are basically acting as nicely as possible in public so that the other one looks like the bad guy once the agreement is in ruins on the floor.
Professor Wedgwood, give me your assessment on the way the Bush administration is handling this ABM issue.
The anti-bomb. Well,
sorry, go ahead.
Sure. On ABM, I think they wanted to gain a kind of momentum from the demonstration of their unyielding intention. It's kind of a Richard Holbrooke technique, if you like. If people are persuaded you're going to bull your way through anyway, they'll tend ultimately to probably accommodate themselves to you rather than give a public appearance of being overcome by you. I do think on the merits of that, that in fact the Russians are not necessarily simply being strategically embarrassing to us, but rather, as one sees in the common ground between Russia, China, and us on the problem of bin Laden in Afghanistan, Russia too feels some nervousness by what could be a problem on its southern tier. So I don't think Putin's simply playing us. And I do think that when you're going to make a break with what has been a very long there's a wonderful lawyer's word, like a key communitaire, acquired body of stuff in arms control, that at times it does pay to announce your intention clearly and handily. On Kyoto, if I just might say.
Sure.
I mean, it's not a left-right Republican-Democrat issue. I mean, Richard Cooper, who was chairman of the National Intelligence Council, your Harvard colleague, Professor Walt, right, had some serious reservations about the Kyoto framework. David Victor of the Council on Foreign Relations, similarly, and the problems of trying to create a property regime and when there's always a moving goalpost in emissions reduction. This is not some sudden affectation of the Bush administration. And I do think that you have to take these treaties one by one, give credit for treaties that have been entered into. And where I might differ is, I guess, a worry with the Bush administration is a worry that if, just as a matter of reliability of negotiating partners, if we reverse positions too easily, it'll put a damper on their willingness to make concessions to us.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the U.S. going it alone on foreign policy. Is the U.S. going alone? What do you think? Is it a trend, a change in philosophy, or just the growing pains of a new administration? And what will be the practical impact of our rejection of these international agreements? Join the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. And this was the response to the American representative in Bonn, Germany last week as the Kyoto Protocols on Global Warming were signed by every nation but the U.S.
The Bush administration takes the issue of climate change very seriously, and we will not abdicate our responsibilities. Mr. President, thank you again for your many contributions to this process.
That was Paula Dobrynsky, the U.S. delegate in Bonn last week. The International Peanut Gallery was not happy with the U.S. that day. Connection listeners, Kyoto is one of a growing list of international agreements the U.S. has recently rejected. What's the meaning of all this, of recent decisions to go it alone? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'd like to bring into the conversation François Heisberg in France. He's the director of the French Foundation for Strategic Research. Welcome, François.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine.
Thank you for joining us. You're very welcome. It's good to have you. Tell us, François, what sentiments were being expressed in the background there of that clip of tape we just heard of Paula Dobrynsky?
Well, probably a good deal of exasperation after what had been a very grueling round of all-night discussions. So I wouldn't actually take that particular episode too seriously. What is more serious is the impression that what Richard Haass, the head of the State Department policy planning staff, calls à la carte multilateralism is actually another way of saying rejection of practically any international commitment. The comprehensive test ban, the International Criminal Court, the Landmine Treaty, Kyoto, the ABM Treaty, the small arms negotiations, the biological verification protocol. It's very easy to list the number of treaties you want to get out of, the administration wants to get out of or doesn't want to ratify. It's impossible to establish a list of treaties which the Bush administration wants to be part of.
But I wonder, I mean, do you think there is a sense in Europe that Mr. Bush may be coming around? I mean, I know your president, for example, last week suggested after he met with Bush and had a discussion with him on the Middle East that this is someone that we can work with after all. And let me make another point. During the campaign, there was a lot of talk about pulling out of the Balkans, for example. Well, when the rubber of reality hits the road, the president is over there. And in fact, we're not going to be pulling out of Europe. Is it as bad as it seems, in other words?
It's true that there are cases where the administration has changed its mind or has moved away from some of its initial positions. The Balkans are one case. The policies vis-à-vis Iraq are another case. But what is very notable, and what certainly the Europeans, as well as America's Asian allies, have noted, is this apparently systematic refusal to enter or to remain bound by international treaties, multilateral treaties or arms control treaties. There doesn't seem to be an exception yet to that particular pattern. And although none of this is quite as dramatic as the rejection by the U.S. Senate in 1919 of the ratification of the Versailles Treaty and of the League of Nations, it looks pretty much like there's a serious pattern here, and people are beginning to wonder whether we aren't seeing an American Senate and a U.S. administration essentially beginning to turn their backs vis-à-vis 60 years of policy. The habits which applied to the period from 1940 onwards now seem to be being challenged.
Let me turn that concern to my two guests here in the States. Professor Wedgwood, starting with you, is there something you could say to our friends in Europe to make them feel better about this?
Well, I would ask them to look at it against the background of engagements that the U.S. has eagerly sought. We have ratified the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We ratified in 1994 the Covenant on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. We supported the Protocol on Minimum Combat Age to deal with the problem of child soldiers in the recent negotiations in Geneva. We've supported the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Convention. So the fact that we don't sign on to every treaty doesn't show that we're some kind of yahoo from some obscure terra incognita. But I do think that, again, the structural problem is to figure out an architecture for negotiations where, vulgar as it sounds, that U.S. interests are not simply treated as one of 189. That won't work. The very logic of the Security Council, the logic of voting in the World Bank, is that the powers with effective responsibility for certain areas must have some greater voice in the shaping of the agenda.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to join the connection conversation. And let me come back to you, Professor Walton, have you respond. What would you say? I mean, do you agree with the sentiment, the concern being expressed by Francois in Europe?
Yeah, I think I'm probably more sympathetic to his position than not. It's quite clear, as Ruth said, that the United States does support some international agreements, and we do so for very good reasons. These agreements are in our interest. A global system that is governed in part by rules, not entirely, because countries will always pursue their own self-interest, but a global system that's governed in part by rules is very much in our interest. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, for example, which significantly restricts the ability of other countries to acquire nuclear weapons, has been supported by the United States since its signing. And it's the reason why we can target countries like North Korea or Iraq that violate its provisions. Without that treaty, we would have no basis for worrying about or for criticizing other countries. The problem the Bush administration has is severalfold. They claim they want a la carte multilateralism, but there don't seem to be many items on the menu that they actually want to eat, at least not yet. And they reject some of these agreements for grounds that strike me as somewhat specious, arguing that they are not perfect, right? They're not perfectly verifiable. Most treaties are not perfectly verifiable. The question is, are you better off without them? And the reasons they have given to the rest of the world for why we're standing apart don't look particularly persuasive to the rest of the world. To basically gut the United Nations agreement on small arms because it might hurt American small arms manufacturers and small arms exports just doesn't look particularly credible to the rest of the world.
But let me stop you there, because I wanted to ask about that, and that is, is it fair to link any administration? I don't want to just pick on the Bush administration's foreign policy with domestic interests. I mean, it seems like that's a perfectly, in one sense, acceptable idea. That is, your foreign policy obviously needs to serve the interests of the rest of the world, but it seems like what the Bush administration is saying, we've got to take care of our folks at home first. And that's a great example.
Yeah, one of the challenges of statecraft is to not allow your foreign policy to be held hostage to narrow interests within a particular country, but rather to support the national interest overall. And again, the problem that they have is sort of twofold. One, because the United States is so big and powerful now, other countries worry about us and other countries resent us. That means American diplomacy, in some sense, has to be conducted with a velvet glove, right? There's no question we've got the mailed fist there, but you want the velvet glove to minimize the degree of international opposition that you face. If we consistently reject agreements because they're not perfect or do not perfectly conform, then precisely the pattern that Francois was pointing to, we reject agreement, people will forget the ones we've signed off on, forget the sort of business as usual cooperation we engage in, and will focus all of their attention on the ways in which the United States is going it alone. And from a sort of realist point of view, that's not smart diplomacy. It leaves us isolated and encourages others to join forces against us.
800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joan is on the line and joins us now. Hello, Joan.
Good morning. I have been trying to figure out why the Bush administration is behaving the way it is on many fronts, but I wonder what your guests would say to this answer. I think that they have decided that they have an inept and uninformed person in the White House, and that they think he'll only be a one-term president. So the effort will...
When you say they, Joan, who are you talking about?
The administration, the people around him. I think the Republicans have decided he's only going to be there for 4 years anyway, and they want to dismantle as much as they can. The only way to build it, to set up a structure their way, both within the United States and in relation to other countries, is to dismantle all the agreements that we have. To say that he is not so interested in foreign policy as he is in people at home is really ignoring the fact that we are ignoring the people at home, and that our rates of poverty, homelessness, joblessness are going up all the time.
Professor Wedgwood, do you want to respond to Joan?
Well, I think that making your positions clear, asking that other people who you're negotiating with begin to take account of your needs and interests is not the same thing as walking away. I'll give you one example, just going back to the International Criminal Court. We tried like the Dickens to put in a compromise provision that would take account of the American worry that there'd be undue, if you like, juridicalization of close questions of how we operate our military on dual-use targeting in Yugoslavia, say. And at that conference at Rome, the Europeans just would not budge. We offered to put it in Article 12, Article 98, Article 112, nowhere. And I think oftentimes, frankly, in the present sort of tant pis mood, if I may, of Europe, the Europeans are happier that we not join and often don't try to compromise.
Chompy meaning sort of tough luck on you kind of sentiment.
I think it's a bit more vulgar, but yeah.
Yeah, right. Just trying to express it palatably. I'm sorry, go ahead, I interrupted.
No, but that really was my point. And I think there was an accumulating sense of frustration, even in the Clinton administration, that we seem to have lost our ability, even with the British oftentimes feeling more European than North Atlantic, lost our ability to bring together a core of states that would help us to explain the equities of various positions. And I think it's an architectural problem. It's a real moment of anxiety on whether the North Atlantic architecture will really hold together. Mm-hmm. But one of the cold reality showers of dealing at the UN is to understand that politics do not stop at the conference door, that there are a lot of narrow interests that other countries express, trying to, for example, forbid various kinds of food imports, that many conferences become vehicles for expressing anti-Israel sentiments, that you have to be very careful. And the very fact that it's multilateral doesn't mean it's good law.
Hmm. François Heisberg, I wanted to bring you back in. I hear you sort of chomping at the bit to get back in on this conversation.
Indeed. I'd like to make a remark and put a question maybe to our American participants here. The remark is that there appears to be an assumption, including in what Professor Wedgwood has said, that somehow the Europeans have become unserious, including the British. Well, when it comes to military affairs, a country like the United Kingdom is not unserious. They're bloody serious. And most of your allies are serious in military affairs as they are in others. And one has to ask oneself a few questions when one is in Washington. When you end up in the same category as Iran or China, on the International Criminal Court, that's the company you're in. You take Kyoto, God knows whose company you're going to be in. As for the biological weapons verification protocol, the Chinese and the Iranians are delighted at having the Americans do their dirty work for them. You have every single one of your allies, Asian or European, on the other side of the barricade on the bio-verification protocol. And when the question was put earlier on about, you know, the weight of industrial concerns, of course industrial concerns are legitimate. But believe me, we have very powerful pharmaceutical industries, for example, in Germany or in Switzerland or in Britain. They were not allowed to determine the position of our governments on the verification of biological weapons. And this is serious stuff. This is not simply about helping the pharma sector. And the question which I'd like to put to our American participants, and it was prompted by something which by a query which Professor Wedgwood, I think, very rightly put forward, and that is, isn't all of this heralding a deeper change, a change in the Atlantic architecture, or even beyond that, what I said earlier on, that is, a move to an American stance in the world more akin to what it was in the first half of the 20th century than what it has been during the second half of the 20th century? Or as Bob Zoellick, Bush's trade representative, put it in a remarkable article he wrote in a British journal called Survival a couple of years ago, where he said essentially American foreign policy is moving back to normal, that is, to pre-1940 practice, to what it was during the 19th century and the pre-1940 period.
François, let me stop you there because this is something that I did want to get to, and that is the historical context. And let me turn first to Professor Walt. Talk about the history. What have been the forces that compel the U.S. to engage in a robust way around the world, or on the flip side, what compels us to look a little more inward, to pull back a little bit?
I think if you take a historic perspective on this, it's pretty clear that the United States has generally refrained from active overseas commitments unless there was a significant threat to the global balance of power. Now, that doesn't mean we weren't engaged economically and in other ways, but in terms of large-scale military and alliance commitments, we did it in World War I when there was a threat to the balance of power. We did it in World War II when there was a threat to the balance of power. In between, of course, we were largely disengaged. And in the Cold War, we obviously were engaged everywhere because we were the principal way of balancing Soviet power. So I think there's a very powerful logic pushing in exactly the way that Zelig wrote about in that article and in exactly the way that François just described. I think you could even go further and say that a good case could be made that, in fact, the Bush administration just doesn't care very much about Europe. It doesn't see a big security problem anywhere in Europe. They'd like to get out of the Balkans. And although Bush said we would stay for a while, he did not say we would do so with much enthusiasm. Right? It clearly indicated that they'd like to still get out. But the key there is they don't want to take the blame for killing NATO. I mean, who wants to be the president who presides over the dissolution of the most successful peacetime alliance in world history? So they wouldn't mind if the Europeans kill off NATO over time, or if it just sort of slowly fades away without anyone really being aware that it's gone. I also believe that the Bush administration thinks the real strategic challenge in the future lies in Asia and is China, and therefore we're going to see a shift away from Europe and towards China. One of the reasons they've been so willing, it seems to me, to sort of buck the European consensus that François pointed to is that deep down in their very heart of hearts, I don't think they care very much about Europe, and their attention is really focused elsewhere.
I want to come back to this and throw that over across the Atlantic and also down to Connecticut to Professor Wedgwood. But first, a brief break. My guests are Yale International Law Professor Ruth Wedgwood, Harvard Professor of International Affairs Stephen Walt, and François Heisberg, Director of the French Foundation for Strategic Research. Connection listeners, what significance can we draw from the recent U.S. rejection of a number of international treaties? Have we taken a turn philosophically? And what will be the practical impact of the U.S. playing hardball in international diplomacy? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about America on the international sidelines. Critics are calling the Bush administration unilateralist or even isolationist. Connection listeners, are we seeing a trend towards going it alone? What do these rejections of a number of international treaties mean for the U.S. and for our role in international diplomacy? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Harvard International Affairs Professor Stephen Walt, Yale International Law Professor Ruth Wedgwood, and François Heisberg, Director of the French Foundation for Strategic Research. He's on the line with us from Paris. David is on the line. David, thank you for joining us.
Actually, and Richard, but that's fine. It seems to me that the Bush administration is only willing to enter into treaties which make it look good while the United States doesn't have to give anything itself. Like the treaty to not have young persons in combat doesn't change anything or make the United States give anything, whereas something like Kyoto or small arms manufacturing means that the United States, just like any other country, would actually have to give a little. And I think it's really sad that one of the, if not the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world, isn't willing to give a little to make the world a better place. And as an American citizen, I feel horrible that our government is doing that.
Professor Wedgwood, let me throw that to you and ask the question, are we willing to give up where our interests are at stake? And look forward a little bit. What sort of other negotiations and treaties are on the horizon that we may be dealing with soon?
Well, let me just take the example that Richard put of the Protocol to the Rights of the Child Convention, where for a long time the U.S. was skeptical about whether it could afford to have a minimum age set for recruitment of troops and combat age. What was hard for us to explain to our allies is that when kids get out of high school at 17, if you don't catch them right then, they may go off and work, particularly before the NASDAQ crash, you know, for a .com or some other burgeoning company. And both the Air Force, Navy, and Army were having great trouble even filling their rosters. So, but at the last session, where I think the Swedish chairlady, Catherine von Heidenstam, was worried about the outcome, the U.S., in fact, at the Pentagon's initiation, decided it could afford to give up a certain number of folks who would otherwise catch, that some risk that in wartime you might not be able to muster people out into combat roles as easily as you might want to. But there, I think, there was very careful consideration of real costs and simply a decision that it was an acceptable trade-off. I guess just if I could just add, on so many of the conventions that are in question, comprehensive test ban, biological weapons, anti-ballistic missile, one can't argue that the U.S. does not take the underlying problem seriously. Weapons of mass destruction is the primary preoccupation of most Washington commissions on terrorism and indeed of the Defense Department. It's just a question of whether you trust that the law will be self-executing or whether you at times have to use harder-nosed methods of making sure that people don't step back. On future conventions, I think we're going to have big trouble on the biosafety convention because it is fundamental to free market and agricultural goods. The ABM saga is going to be a long and painful one for both sides. And I don't think we're going to walk away from global warming. I do think that it's going to be incumbent on the Bush administration to put forward proposals that are more realistic in terms of their historical starting place.
I wanted to come back to something that Professor Walt brought up just before the break, and that is this idea that the Bush administration is really giving up on Europe. François Heisberg over there in Paris, is there fear about that? Does there seem to be an acknowledgement that that, and do you agree with that?
I would agree to a certain extent. I wouldn't say that there is a fear. I think people fully understand and accept that America's basic strategic concerns are going to be in East Asia and the Middle East because that's where the really nasty stuff could happen. And it's perfectly natural and normal for the U.S. To rebalance its military priorities to take account of that changing strategic landscape. That does not mean that it would be wise for the Americans to, as it were, turn their backs on their European friends, and I don't think we've reached that point yet, thank goodness. But I would want to draw people's attention to the fact that in all of the cases we have been discussing until now, the Europeans and the Asian democracies have tended to be operating together on one side with the U.S. on the other side with countries like China or Iran. Countries like Japan, like Australia, like New Zealand, South Korea, these countries tend to share the same views as the Europeans tend to on the sorts of issues we've been talking about. So it's not European multilateralism versus American Asian priorities. It's American national unilateralism versus other democracies' viewpoints. That's somewhat different than saying that well, it's perfectly natural for the U.S. to turn towards Asia.
Professor Walt.
Yeah, Ruth is absolutely correct to say that no country does or should sign an agreement that's not in its interest. The question is entirely one of the sort of net benefit. If you have to make some sacrifices, do you get more out of the agreement? So to take the Biological Weapons Convention just as an example, there are concerns that this would allow foreigners to gain some access to what American pharmaceutical companies are doing through the various inspection provisions. But it's interesting that lots of other countries that have pharmaceutical industries don't seem to see this as a particular problem. And it's basically a situation where you're taking a very open society like the United States and making it just a little bit more open, right? Which may involve some small cost. But what you gain is you take lots of countries that are very closed, very hard to scrutinize, and you give us some access. It is at least ironic that we've spent the last decade trying to get inspectors into Iraq because we think it's important, even though we understand the Iraqis may be able to hide some things. But we'd like to get in there. Yet on this convention, we walked away from it, even though it would have provided some of those benefits. So again, we shouldn't sign treaties that aren't in our interest, but it should worry us when everybody else seems to think these agreements are in their interest and we're left either by ourselves or in the company of countries that we don't agree with on very much else.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Susanna is on the line.
Yes, following up on that comment, I would like to, having worked for, since the beginning on the treaty to ban landmines, to emphasize that in fact, such a treaty should be considered by the U.S. government to be in our interest. And just to put some perspective on it, I don't think that this unilateralism is necessarily only a product of the or new in the Bush administration. It may be becoming more severe, but certainly on landmines, on the criminal court, and on things like the Convention of the Rights of the Child, which we have not ratified, which is the most widely ratified international treaty that exists, I believe. The Clinton administration also walked away, and we experienced this process in the efforts to put forward a very strong landmines treaty. And the U.S. walked away at a point when most of the nations of the world, Asia, Africa, many parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Europe, banned this weapon. And the treaty so far, even without the United States or Russia or China on it, has been extraordinarily effective in reducing production, reducing the use of mines, and assuring much more treatment for those who have been the victims of this weapon of mass destruction, as we call it, in slow motion. And the U.S. is paying the price for the use of landmines in the cleanup effort to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And we don't believe that the Pentagon, which has opposed it repeatedly, has strong arguments that are any stronger than the humanitarian imperative of banning this weapon.
Susanna, hold that thought. Let me, because I want to throw a point you raised over to François Heisberg, and that is this idea that President Clinton, you made the point that President Clinton and his administration opposed some of these treaties as well. My question to you, François, is how different is this? Is this a question of a difference in style more than anything?
I think there's a substantial difference, and that is during the Clinton administration, we had an executive which was, as it were, giving in to pressure, particularly from the Senate, which was desirous to go unilateral, and the non-ratification, the rejection of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was a good example of that. And now we have an administration which appears to be very much in phase, in tune with the unilateralist mood of the legislative branch. So the novelty is that what used to be a contentious area now appears to have become a more or less a consensus area. You take something like the renewal of the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, which was one of the more unilateralist measures of the Senate some five or six years ago. Well, it's been renewed by an overwhelming majority of the Senate, the Republicans naturally, but most of the Democrats also. So I think this is a deep shift in American attitudes towards its relationship with the outside world, which I think we are witnessing something pretty much along the lines we discussed earlier, the Bob Zoellick notion that we are moving back towards a pre-1940 style, not isolationist in the way it was during a few years in the 30s, but unilateralist and tending to avoid untangling commitments where they can be avoided, not dismantling NATO, as was very aptly put, but certainly not building new ones.
Susanna, I want to thank Susanna for her call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. You know, question for my two American guests. I mean, it seems like any time you have a discussion about a presidential, an administration's commitments abroad, one of the challenges you face is how people think about it at home. And what I'm talking about, I covered the presidential campaign, and the issue of foreign policy did not come up. Hardly at all. The candidates didn't bring it up, and certainly in sort of informal conversations with voters from coast to coast, it didn't come up. So in a sense, doesn't that sort of pull the rug out from under administrations coming up with a policy that really takes into account interests beyond our shores?
I think it does. You're absolutely right. The foreign policy didn't play much of a role in the campaign, and it's worth making a comparison with the Clinton administration. You'll recall when Clinton took office, he said he was going to focus like a laser beam on
Bosnia.
On the economy, right, and basically pay as little attention to foreign policy as he possibly could. Mm-hmm. What Clinton discovered, and what I think you will find the Bush administration discovering, is it's harder to walk away from the world than you think. It's harder to be unilateralist than you think it is. The world, even given America's extraordinary position, you know, where we spend more on defense than the next seven countries combined, where our economy is one-third of the world's economy, and the number two economy is 60% smaller than ours. Even a world like that can reach out and bite us in a variety of ways. And interestingly enough, the Bush administration likes to say that every now and then, that, you know, the world has still got dangers out there that we have to protect ourselves against. And the problem is, if you can't walk away entirely from the world, you have to find ways to cooperate or collaborate with the rest of the world. But you can't do that if your consistent policy is simply to declare what the American position is, pretend to listen, but not to hear.
Mm-hmm. Professor Wedgwood, what can we look forward to? What is coming down? What's ahead in terms of negotiating new international treaties that we're going to be paying attention to?
Well, I think, frankly, the focus is going to turn more to a kind of old-fashioned great power diplomacy. It's going to be our attempt to work out functional bilateral relationships with the Chinese and the Russians, and to worry about the balance of power in Southeast Asia as Indonesia falls apart. I don't think there's going to be a great initiative now for new feel-good multilateral agreements that are coming from us. There's a work agenda that the Europeans have and the so-called like-minded caucus and a lot of the NGO community on trying to deal with humanitarian issues through multilateral means. But I think the skepticism, if I just might revert back to your earlier
point. We have about 10 seconds remaining, so
10 seconds.
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
Anyway, to Francois, I think the accusation probably is that Europe is not serious about real military affairs in Asia, anti-terrorism, and anti-missile.
Thank you very much to my guest today. Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. Ruth Wedgwood, professor of international law at Yale. And Francois Heisberg directs the French Foundation for Strategic Research. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is The Connection. I'm dancing with myself.